Because of the lack of Korean faces, the Stammtisch attendees feel free to let their guard down and speak a bit more openly. Though there's no doubt the place is bugged. Still, the buzz of the crowd would presumably make it difficult to pick up on any one conversation, particularly given the plurality of languages being spoken. 7 European countries have diplomatic missions in the DPRK, while 2 more have cooperation offices. I fall into conversation with one weathered ambassador. In my experience, he says, the embassy people working here tend to go through 3 phases. The first is where you think you finally get it and understand how this country really operates. The second, where you get frustrated and realize you don't understand anything. And the last is when you realize you don't understand anything and no longer care because you'll be out of here soon. I ask if he's personally experienced all 3 phases. He has, after all, been in Pyongyang for more than a year now. The ambassador shakes his head. I'm at stage 2. I know I'll eventually get to stage 3, but I want it to last as shortly as possible, because that's where cynicism sets in, and that gets you nowhere. Nor does it do any good for the people you're ostensibly here to help. In the near absence of anything that could be deemed normal diplomatic relations, most of the foreign embassies work very closely with the NGOs stationed here. As these aid organizations tend to be staffed with people from the represented countries, the dividing line is very thin. The feeling of mutual belonging, of quasi-familial community among these outsiders, is apparent. Moments of frustration are a common theme in conversation. Another newly arrived ambassador joins our conversation. He tells us he had been on a trip the past weekend with 2 of his Korean staff members. While embassy staff are permitted to travel virtually anywhere they want within Pyongyang city limits, they must apply for permission to travel outside the city and are always accompanied by Koreans. The ambassador began to realize that the answer to every question he asked his Korean colleagues was a lie. So he eventually reached the point where he gave up and chose not to ask them anything. In response, the weathered ambassador ventures, "The most honest thing one of my Korean colleagues ever told me was, I've been told not to tell you." It is unsurprising that a paranoid regime would be paranoid when it comes to diplomatic missions. One of the implicit tasks of a diplomat, after all, is intelligence gathering. Historians' best source of information regarding the inner workings of Kim Il-sung's early government comes from the dispatches of the diplomats stationed here that were found in the files open to the public after the fall of the Soviet Union. NGO workers are similarly regarded as potential spies. The Koreans assigned to work with foreigners are naturally tasked to uphold a disinformation regimen. "I wonder at times whether they lie to each other as well," the first ambassador continues. "I sometimes think it might be even worse here than it was in the GDR, where a father couldn't trust his own son. I suspect it probably is." "They live in fear," concludes the second ambassador. "All of them." Again, the Warmbier case comes up. Again, I am told to be careful. "You never know," I hear. "They're always looking for a reason, and sometimes there is no reason." Opinions are regaled with the tired expressions of those who have been enduring monitoring, conflicting reports, mixed messages, and outright lies for extended durations. Even though they are somewhat sheltered from the harsh realities that Koreans themselves have to confront, have access to the internet, albeit with slow connections that are most likely also monitored by DPRK authorities, and can travel outside the country, as a rule, most embassies and NGOs require their employees to take a breather once every 3 months. The psychological realities of working in such an environment have their consequences. The overall effect is less distrust and paranoia. At least here tonight, they are among friends and colleagues in whom they can confide. And more extreme fatigue, with an underlying sadness and greater or lesser degrees of cynicism. There are exceptions, of course. People whose power of empathy borders on the transcendent. Those capable of disengaging from those unpleasant aspects of their daily encounters to wrench something of the universally human out of them. One employee of the Polish embassy studied Korean in Warsaw for several years before she arrived here. She prefers to speak of cultural differences between herself and her North Korean colleagues. Gabriella is an Australian occupational therapist here with a healthcare NGO. She's been here for less than a month and still retains a cheery air. Her job, however, is not without its difficulties. She works with the physically disabled, from young children to the elderly. I've never seen any disabled people in my travels to the DPRK. I ask her about a rumor that they have been forbidden from residing in Pyongyang since the early 1980s, so as not to tarnish the city's appearance and status as the showcase capital. She nods her head sadly. "That may have been true up to about 5 years ago," she says. "But my organization has done a lot of work to change that. People are becoming more educated." Still, getting around is extremely difficult for those less able, which may account for why they are rarely seen in public. For those unable to walk, there is nothing in the way of electric wheelchairs available. The wheelchairs they do have are rickety things that have been donated. As if that does not make it difficult enough to navigate, none of the buildings have been designed with accessibility in mind. Given the power shortages, elevators cannot always be relied upon. Despite these hardships, Gabriella tells me her patients welcome her each day with warmth, kindness, and affection. Their suspicion and distrust of her as a foreigner, which, like all other North Koreans, had been programmed into them from a young age, quickly dissipated. Within minutes of their first meeting, the children cuddled in her lap. The elderly addressed her as tenderly as though she were their daughter. Toward the end of the Stammtisch, Alexander suggests we use our extra time before pickup to go walking through the embassy district. I hesitate. I've been told repeatedly throughout the night that I'm in danger, to watch myself, to be careful. Alexander, being French, does not have to endure such repeated warnings. Yet he had also been fortunate enough to experience Pyongyang in a comparatively unsupervised way, since he was on a student visa last time he was here. The entire trip, he has been itching to get away from the ever-watchful presence of Ro and Min, and to walk through the streets freely. Now's our chance, albeit in a rather limited way. The Munsudong district is anyway restricted to foreigners, with a Korean guard at the entrance prohibiting all but the authorized from entering. Still, I'm not sure. Something so innocent as going for a walk unsupervised. Who knows? Could the Koreans use that as an excuse to arrest me? Claim it as evidence that I'm a spy? If they could accuse a drunken 21-year-old student of working for the CIA, what could they do to a 36-year-old writer? "It will be fine," Alexander insists. "Let's just walk to the entrance of the compound. We can wait for them there. They will appreciate it. That way they don't have to stop and argue with the guard." I agree, though I am nervous the entire time. Anyway, there isn't a lot to see at night. A row of gates and shrubbery hiding small houses containing the embassies and residences. The streets eerily bereft of pedestrians and traffic. I'm startled when Alexander's phone suddenly rings. But it's only Alec. A rare excuse to use those newly purchased Coriolink phones. To tell him they're on their way to pick us up. Alexander winks at me, tells him we'll wait at the entrance by the guard post. Chapter 22. I'm never alone, and it's starting to drive me crazy. It couldn't have occurred to me, the moment I so eagerly signed up to come on this trip, that the biggest challenge of spending a month in North Korea might in fact be a psychological one. My earlier sojourns had all lasted 1 week or less, a quick in and out back to the polluted chaos of Beijing's familiar streets. Now, it seems I underestimated the duress of spending an uninterrupted month in the strangeness of this other world. As a writer, I am accustomed to spending a great deal of time alone. That's normal for me. It's what makes me feel comfortable. I'm not antisocial. I enjoy being around people I like, at least, But it has to be balanced by an equal or greater amount of solitude, or else I find myself approaching a discomforting edge. Being around people constantly, it's exhausting. People you hardly know. People you only have a limited means of knowing. You are never able to let your guard down and relax under such circumstances. You are constantly having to perform. Especially here, where your self-censoring device must be turned on at all times. This might come naturally to the Koreans born and raised in this environment, who have been conditioned from childhood to operate in this way. But for everyone else, such restraint requires a great deal of mental energy. Then, at those rare moments when you are alone, it feels creepy, as though someone is either watching you unseen or else listening, or both. They hear everything. Even when you don't think they're listening, they often are. On the way back to the hotel, staring out the window at the empty, well-lit streets of the nocturnal city center, I experience wells of a strange emotion I haven't felt for a long time. Fear. In my half-drunken exhaustion, a menagerie of voices swells up in my head. But where I feel it the most is my chest. Everybody is reporting on everyone else. They're all watching, always telling. They know everything. Great danger. Great danger. It suddenly strikes me how cut off we are here. We haven't had news from the outside world in the past 2 weeks. We had our chance tonight and last week. We could have asked the expats, who all have internet access, any news from outside? But strangely, it didn't even occur to any of us to ask. We've forgotten. How easy it would be for the outside world, then, to forget all about us, were we to disappear. I am, in fact, completely alone here, while paradoxically never being alone. The insanity of the situation. What have I gotten myself into? Here I am, sitting in a van with a group of strangers, all of whom would be completely and utterly helpless to come to my aid were I to get into trouble. Sure, Min is great, the cool North Korean. But in the event that someone high above her, decided to make an example out of me, would she really be able to do anything about it? To do so, really, would be to put herself at risk. That's how the system operates. You report on others, turn others in, but certainly don't come to anyone's defense once they've been accused. To do that would be to admit complicity, your participation in their crime. If it's your own spouse, save yourself. Volunteer to pull the trigger. And Alec and Alexander? I have great affection for them both, but as I look at them, it suddenly occurs to me that they're kids. It's not even an age thing. Even if they weren't 10, 12 years my junior, what help would they be in dealing with the arbitrary arrest and detainment of a fellow student? Then there's the Atrocity Museum, to which I continue to return in my mind. As gory and brutal as the contents of the museum are, they are actually the least disturbing thing about the entire experience. Clearly, the model for the Sinchon Museum are the Holocaust museums and memorial sites tourists can visit in Europe. But those places are suffused with a historical context that is utterly absent in Sinchon. A history that we all know that has been verified by countless sources. When you visit, say, the House of the Wannsee Conference in Berlin, where the mass murder of Europe's Jews was coolly plotted by the Nazi elite, the layout of the place is rooted in a chronological, detailed outline that emphasizes not merely what took place, but how and why the events depicted and documented came to occur. In Sinchon, there are no hows, no whys. What you have, besides the set of gruesome displays, is a rhetoric that boils the conflict down to an imaginary battle between good and evil. The pure, innocent-hearted Korean civilians and the heartless American bastard imperialists. Never once are the Americans clarified as soldiers, either. When they are referred to, it is as American imperialists, or else, to make them less than human, wolves animals. The entire context in which these crimes allegedly took place is erased. It was a war. A civil war. To say that these crimes were perpetrated by Americans, not American soldiers or even perhaps the U.S. government, but simply Americans, is to imply that not only were all Americans complicit in these actions, but all Americans are essentially like that. Animals, as it is repeated throughout, up until the very end. Finally, by putting the blame on the American bastards, the North Koreans are able to evade the painful and traumatic truth that the horrendous crimes committed against them and that they committed against others were Korean on Korean. The civilness of the Civil War has been eradicated. The lack of self-reflection and criticality in the North Korean education system means that Koreans often don't even realize it when they blatantly contradict themselves in speech. As anyone who has tried to make their way through one of Kim Jong-il's books or speeches, or read an editorial in the Rodong Sinmun, will tell you, the rhetoric of the propaganda is such a mishmash of impassioned confusions, of chest-beating bellicosities, that very little in the way of coherent sense can be extracted from it. This is damaging because, for foreign visitors at least, it obscures any shred of truth regarding what might have actually taken place in Sinchon. What we're presented with is a fake historical museum that appeals only to the emotions. This, indeed, is one of the key tactics that the system uses to infantilize its populace, teaching them to feel rather than think. Where the only guiding principle is this primitive notion of good and evil. The same primitive notions that certain Western politicians like to promote when propagandizing against North Korea, the axis of evil. Reason and logic are completely absent in such environs. Irrational fear, paranoia, flowed in to fill the gap. Chapter 23. So, what really happened in Sinchon? In his novel, The Guest, which is based on a series of interviews conducted with a North Korean pastor who had been living in Sinchon at the time that the massacres took place, Wang Suk-young attributes two foreign guests, imposed on Korea during the process of colonization and division, as the ultimate ideological causes of the unrest and violence: Christianity and Marxism. Christianity had been introduced to Sinchon quite early on. During the Japanese occupation of the country, there were also a large number of pro-independence freedom fighters active in the region. Economically, Sinchon was situated in one of the wealthiest regions above the 38th parallel. After Korea was liberated from Japan, many of the young people living there opposed the communist suppression of religion and policy of land distribution. They were left with two choices: either defect to South Korea, or stay and form covert anti-communist underground operations, sporadically putting up resistance against the forces of the Korean People's Army. According to South Korean historian Han Sung-hoon, when the North's military units retreated from Sinchon in October 1950, local communist guerrilla units formed to take their place, battling the South Korean and U.S.-led UN forces that had moved into the area. In short, Sinchon and its surroundings had been a hotbed of both rightist and leftist aggression in the moments leading up to the massacre of late 1950. When U.S. and South Korean forces moved in, it gave the rightist guerrillas the upper hand in the battle. Although the Korean People's Army was forced to retreat from the Sinchon region during this period, neither the U.S. nor South Korea was able to gain complete control over it either, owing to the confused morass of multiple guerrilla factions and the spate of retaliatory killings that would occur whenever one of these groups managed a brief triumph over the others. Han writes, "This kind of revenge killing reveals the nature of the civil war in Korea, which cannot be understood as a mere temporary flash of emotional vendetta. From the end of Japanese colonial rule and national liberation to the formation of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the war was the explosive result of continued economic and religious conflict between the left and the right. In the years following the massacre, with the Korean War raging on, the Belgium-based International Association of Democratic Lawyers, alarmed by rumors of a civilian massacre in Sinchon, dispatched teams of human rights specialists to the region to investigate in 1951 and 1952. On each visit, they interviewed numerous witnesses. In the resulting report, the group stated that they found overwhelming evidence that U.S. soldiers had carried out mass and individual killings of civilians, including women and children. This is the same report in which it would come to light that the U.S. had deployed chemical weapons and germ warfare against the enemy, something that the U.S. continues to deny. For his part, Huang, in the process of researching his novel, interviewed a number of witnesses from Sinchon who claimed the massacres that took place had actually been perpetuated by Koreans against Koreans, and that the violence was committed on both sides of the political divide. Kwak Pok-hyun, a South Korean who was himself part of an anti-communist guerrilla unit during the war, has claimed that the massacre was carried out by Korean right-wing security units. Kwak even admitted that he himself had taken part in the massacre of civilians, but that the number of civilians killed was greatly exaggerated by the North Koreans. According to Kwak, one of the acts of mass murder took place not long after the U.S. crossed the 38th parallel and Christian right-wing guerrilla forces took over the security of the area surrounding Sinchon. After hiding out at a military base in nearby Mount Kuol, communist fighters began coming back to Sinchon because they were starving. They were rounded up by the Christian rightists, who then led dozens of communists into a mud hut in an apple orchard and set it ablaze. Anyone who attempted to escape the mass incineration was hacked to death with pitchforks. Other sources claim that the massacres were carried out by a secret police unit dispatched by South Korea's dictator Syngman Rhee shortly after the U.S. troops took control of the area. This would imply that while the U.S. troops themselves did not carry out the massacre, they certainly would have witnessed, or at least known about it, and did nothing to stop it. The Sinchon massacre, concludes Han, cannot be understood simply as killings between the left and the right. It must be understood three-dimensionally, as the explosive result of the contradictions emanating from the colonial period after liberation, combined with the division and establishment of two separate states in the North and South, and eventual war, which exacerbated internal problems of class, hierarchy, and religion. Why did the North Koreans wait until 1958 to build the museum in Sinchon? The answers to this are rooted in that politically crucial period in the country's history. In 1956, Khrushchev gave his notorious secret speech, whose contents would soon become not so secret, spreading throughout the communist world. In the speech, he denounced the crimes and personality cult of his predecessor, Kim Il-sung's role model Joseph Stalin. Behind the scenes in the DPRK, factions engaged in a fierce ideological battle, with many in Kim's government expressing sympathy with the currents being espoused in the Soviet Union. Currents that essentially amounted to a repudiation of Stalin-esque personality cults, such as the one that Kim Il-sung and his circle of supporters were very much keen on emulating. Steps had to be taken to curtail these currents, to isolate the country from Soviet influence, and assert that there would only be one way, our way, forward. The Songbun system was created. Juche, the doctrine of ultra-nationalistic self-reliance, was asserted, eventually overtaking Marxism-Leninism as the official state ideology. Purges eliminated all competing factions, putting an end to all political pluralism in the DPRK by early 1959. Kim's turn toward ultranationalism was motivated by more than just a domestic power struggle. There were also military concerns. Kim had called for all foreign troops to withdraw from the Korean Peninsula. In 1958, the Chinese People's Volunteers, which had troops in the north to support the country in the event of another war's eruption, followed suit. The Korean People's Army became the sole military force in the north, a situation that endures to this day. Not only did the U.S. and the South not follow suit, in 1957-1958, Americans installed nuclear weapons in South Korea, essentially breaking the armistice agreement. This greatly alarmed the North Koreans, who protested the move, all to no avail. The fear and paranoia within the regime and populace, provoked by the U.S.'s installation of nuclear weapons on the peninsula, exacerbated anti-Americanism into official state doctrine. The North Koreans had, of course, been anti-American ever since the Korean War, but the virulence with which it continues to this day had its origins in the late 1950s. And the first major state-sponsored iteration of this anti-American sentiment was the construction of the Sinchon Museum of American War Atrocities. This is the museum's real historical significance. In the DPRK, history cannot just be history in the way it is in most developed countries. A dormant thing, lying in the past, a passive actor in the construction of present and future. To North Koreans, it is as though these atrocities took place yesterday. They also serve as warnings that the very same thing could very well happen again, tomorrow even, or in an hour from now. Hypervigilance, then, is demanded of all citizens. It is one of the things that makes you a North Korean. Your past, current, and potential future victimization at the hands of hostile forces. A nation whose traumatic past cannot be merely buried, but continues to inform the psychopathology of daily life. Fear must be deeply and endlessly ingrained in the populace for the enabling belief to continue. And it is the role of the regime and its propaganda to perpetuate that fear. Just like the top-down political structure, fear also operates vertically in the DPRK. This is the ultimate source of all the paranoia you begin to detect on street level, and experience personally when you stick around for long enough, as I have come to realize. It is something deeper than the mere Orwellian nightmare of the police state, of being under constant surveillance, of your fellow citizens spying and reporting on you. That might be bad, but surely it can't be worse than the nefarious forces of the outside world which want to see you destroyed in the most gruesome way possible. To North Koreans, though, there is a remedy for that constant threat. There is one more building in the museum in Sinchon that foreigners are not allowed to enter. An oath-taking spot, where groups are meant to congregate after their tour of the museum. Curse the American imperialists for committing these crimes against them, and vow to take their revenge. An expression of solidarity. Unity through hatred, but unity nonetheless. Part 6. Victory Day. Chapter 24. It's a holiday, so no school. Victory Day is celebrated each year on July 27th, the day the armistice that ended the Korean War was signed. The day the DPRK won the war. The national imperative to commemorate this date surfaces even in consumer culture. The brand of cigarettes smoked by Kim Jong-un is 727. They come in luxurious cream-colored packaging. Gold letters bearing the brand name embossed above a gray engraving of a soldier wielding the victory flag. Priced at $7, they are the most expensive cigarettes for sale in the country, outpricing even imported foreign brands. The day starts with a visit to the zoo, which Alexander and I requested because we've never been. And Alec hasn't been since the renovation. Like virtually every amusement avenue in Pyongyang, it was recently refurbished at great expense. In fact, the opening was just last weekend, according to the new edition of the Pyongyang Times. Hua drives us through a thick swarm around the huge tiger mouth forming the main entrance. It's only 9 a.m., but already there's quite a crowd. We step out into this panoply of Pyongyangites representing all walks of life. Families and soldiers and students and elites with young children. All decked out in their Victory Day finest, pressed shirts and colorful galoshes following the morning's light showers. During the Kim Jong-il years, the Pyongyang Zoo enjoyed a rather dismal reputation among foreign residents. Tales abounded of half-starved beasts howling in minuscule cages. Rumor had it that they were nourished with the flesh of executed political prisoners. Conditions have improved enormously since then, though that's not saying much. It's still a zoo. In a country whose circus still makes use of dancing bears, an animal rights discourse is decidedly absent. The concept alone would sound comical to most North Koreans. Man is the master of the universe, not bear. Inside, children shriek with delight as they throw chips and crackers into the cages. Signs indicate not only breed, but through which Kim the animal was gifted, whether directly or indirectly, via some other dubious luminary of second and third world politics. An elephant from Ho Chi Minh, presented to great leader Kim Il-sung in Jucha 48, 1959. A Cuban crocodile presented to the dear leader Kim Jong-il by the Cuban embassy in Jucha 69, 1980. A lion from Robert Mugabe. There is a separate house for dogs and cats. Household pets are uncommon in Pyongyang, so according to local logic, such creatures should naturally be showcased in the zoo. A trio of gray mutts stand at abrupt attention at the end of a steel cage, separating us by a waist-sized concrete partition. "Go ahead, the one in the middle hasn't had one yet," a young mother instructs her toddler, who gleefully tosses in a cracker and then watches the dogs fight over the morsel before popping one into her own mouth. When another cracker lands on the concrete partition, just on the other side of the fence, Hua approaches and nudges it with the end of his umbrella till it lands within dog reach. There's a long, unmoving line waiting to get inside the penguin house. Apparently, as foreigners, we're allowed to jump it, as we're immediately ushered in. Inside, we join a group of college-aged elites for whom a private viewing has been arranged. They stand around casually chatting and snapping photos and videos of the penguins, who swim back and forth in the aquarium against a painted desert island backdrop. Another popular attraction is the talking parrots. Min elbows her way through the crowd of children to record the creatures, which have been trained to croak out, "Annyeong!" Hi, when you toss them a cracker. Elsewhere, a mobile photo studio offers laminated photos of your tots seated on a live pony. Sample photos show entire families weighing down the poor beast's back. In a windowed enclosure, two vultures groom each other's elongated necks. "They're filleting each other," Min exclaims. I grimace, suspecting a misused verb, but decide to leave it. Perhaps they are filleting each other. What do I know about vultures?
"Oh, look! He has scratches!" Min squeals in childish delight. "It looks like he has a skin condition."
"Maybe it's a disease," I suggest.
"No," Min shakes her head and points at the other vulture. "It's definitely this big guy."
Out in the parking lot, several grasshoppers, the poorest women of grandmotherly age who dodge the authorities from place to place, illegally selling all sorts of goods out of their knapsacks, squat, briskly exchanging candy and wrapped ice creams for won and hard currency. We hover near the Kim Il-sung monument as we wait for Min to return from a bathroom break. Standing around our van, I notice some security types, young and tall with attractive, well-fed features, in pristine navy blue suits and trendy South Korean haircuts, gaze shielded behind Ray-Bans. Suddenly, like an owl nabbing its prey, one of these guys swoops in on an old lady vendor and drags her off violently. I try to follow their path discreetly, but they disappear behind a row of buses in the rear of the parking lot. Wherever she's been taken, it's not going to end well for her. Speeding through Pyongyang, a feeling of lightness overtakes me. It's cloudy this afternoon, but the trees are still in bloom. The eerie caterwauling of a folk song blares through the radio speakers, and the darkness within has temporarily melted away. I guess I've been struck with the Victory Day spirit. Outside, the streets are filled with young people. Everyone looks so beautiful. The boys in suits, girls decked out in multicolored flowing chosunot. It's a national holiday, and they're on their way to a mass dance. We're going to join them, but first we'll stop in for a quick coffee at the Changwongsun Hotel, across from the conical Pyongyang ice rink. I hum along to the chorus of the Moranbong band's Let's Go to Mount Paektu. These catchy tunes, they're everywhere. The car radio, sure, but also in every restaurant and shop you go into. The music sings itself into your brain. After a few days, you start to hear it, even when it's not playing. The will of the people. The single-minded unity. To be discovered in these sweet melodies. The never-ending soundtrack of North Korea. Decode the harmonies to discover the truth. Perhaps it is far too easy, an overassumption, to say that everyone here is living a lie. It is more like no one is lying. It's just that nobody is quite telling the truth either. Pulling into the roundabout hotel entrance, we see a North Korean girl in university attire standing next to a dough-faced guy with blonde hair and blue eyes. They turn toward our approaching van. He gives us an intense stare. Who the hell is that? Putain. Alexander curses and emits an ominous sigh. I know that guy, and he's not supposed to be here. The Changwang Sun's entrance is crowded with young people going in and out to use the lobby bathrooms. The mass dance is to be held at 3 p.m. across the street in front of the Pyongyang Indoor Stadium. I've never been inside, but according to a local guidebook, it was completed in Jucha 62, 1973, and is the largest indoor stadium in the country. It is here where Dennis Rodman played basketball in front of Kim Jong-un. Actually, says Alexander under his breath, I know both of them. The girl, too. He climbs out of the van, Alex and me close behind. The Korean girl in the Kim Il-sung University uniform is speaking in Parisian-accented French to the young man. She's one of the Koreans who came to Alexander's university as part of the exchange. When she sees Alexander approaching, her face lights up.
Alexander! Mon frère!
Alexander bows and embraces her. Myung-hwa looks after all the French students studying at Kim Il-sung University. At the moment, there is a grand total of one, and he is standing before us. Patrice and Alexander greet each other stiffly. Last time Alexander was in Pyongyang, he and Myung-hwa forged a special bond. She even bent the rules and helped clandestinely arrange for him to have dinner one night with a businessman he had met at a North Korean restaurant in Dubai. Malheureusement, now she really has to go. She was just bidding adieu to Patrice when we drove up. Shall we have a beer? Patrice asks after waving her off. I don't drink, says Alexander. Not when I'm here, I mean. But I'll have a tea or something.
Bon, on y va.
The rest of us trail behind them into the Changwon Sun lobby, where we're greeted with a large oil painting of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il grinning on top of Mount Paektu. We make a sharp right and turn into the ground floor restaurant. Though much of the hotel has fallen into modest disrepair and is now mainly used by budget-conscious Chinese businessmen, the restaurant is still a favorite among well-heeled residents of the Central District. I've been doing nothing but drinking, Patrice spits out in rapid-fire French, pleased to be speaking to a compatriot for the first time in 4 months. It's so fucking boring here. There's nothing to do but drink, drink, drink. It takes me 4 beers just to get into bed at night. Otherwise I can't sleep. And you know something funny? He leans in, a strange expression, glassy-eyed paranoia. I never drank before I came here. Patrice shoots us a quick smile, his eyes darting back and forth. His teeth have a weird gray gauze to them, almost as though they are sheathed in some transparent substance, an artificial glaze. Alec and I will later debate whether it's due to all the drinking or else some kind of newly acquired mineral deficiency. For now, Alec has already retreated to another table with Min and Ro. Your friend here, he understands French? I do, but decide to play dumb. Patrice turns and addresses me, in Korean of all languages, even though I'm as blonde as he is and Alexander has already mentioned I'm American. Abruptly, he rises and makes his way to the bar to order another beer. Will you come back? Alexander calls after him, confused and exasperated.
Oui, oui.
Travis, Alexander says, now turning to me. I'm very sorry for this, but could you please go over there and sit with Alec? I promise I will tell you everything later. Anyway, the festivities are about to begin, so Alec and I venture across the street to the square fronting the Pyongyang Indoor Stadium. Mass dances, featuring hundreds of young people, typically university students, are held in cities throughout the country on virtually every national holiday. For men, the required uniform is black slacks, smart black dress shoes, a white-collared shirt, can be long or short-sleeved, and red necktie. For women, chosonot, color optional. Today, a flourishing of pink and lavender. Expressions on the students' faces range from blank to awkward to just plain bored, revealing the inevitable lack of enthusiasm for these typically drafted activities, whether they be military parades, mass dances, or manual labor. Participation is mandatory when your number is called, lest you pay to get out of it or otherwise find someone to take your place. At the preordained time, the dancers congregate in orderly lines in the parking lot. When the announcement is made via the huge speakers erected on either side of the entrance to the building, the students move forward. With uniformed marshals guiding them, they are led into circular formations. The music begins, and they commence a stiff shuffle. Each song features a specific choreographed combination. Nothing very challenging. Ballroom light. A couple of steps toward your partner, swing your arms back and forth, twirl around once, arm in arm, detach, three steps back, raise arms to the heavens, clap, repeat. Next, a variation on the foxtrot, with as little bodily contact as possible. One defector I met in South Korea, who had herself once been drafted to participate in a mass dance, told me that there wasn't any preparation. There are some who just appear to know the steps. Others follow. Keep one eye on the girl in front of you, another eye to your right to copy what the guy beside you is doing. As the circles rotate at given moments, your dance partner will change throughout the afternoon's repertoire. The circles are imperfectly gender balanced. Where they are, boys dance with boys, the girls with girls. It's all fairly mechanical, and most of the couples strive to avoid making eye contact. And it all takes place beneath the watchful eyes of the Kims, who smile down upon the crowd from their enormous official portraits posted above the stadium's main entrance. Guards block off the square from the street. Beyond the barricade, a few local onlookers stand and watch. But mostly, the scene seems to be set up for foreign tourists, who are free to mill about, film and take photos, even join in, which a few do, to the amusement and embarrassment of most of the participants, who are forced to integrate their clumsy improvised steps into the circles. After a few tunes that sound hopelessly dated to the whimsical 1940s, the energy lifts as the opening bars to Dash Towards the Future resound. A sudden enthusiasm infects the dancers as they launch into their routine. Three steps forward march, three steps backward march, three to the right with arms raised in flight, clap, spin to the left with hands on hips, then do it all over again. 45 minutes into it, the mass dance comes to an abrupt, fanfareless end. The dancers leave their orderly circles to form orderly lines. A command is shouted into the microphone, and off they march into the parking lot. Some get into waiting buses. Most, however, merge into the pedestrian traffic, off to home, or perhaps a next assignment. In the parking lot, Patrice and Alexander wait next to our van. This is Patrice's last day in Pyongyang, it turns out, so this brief hello was also a goodbye. It was nice to meet you, says Patrice, turning to me and Alec, finally drunk enough to speak English. Have a great time here. The Korean people are the best. He flashes an insincere smile. Really? Later that night, Alexander tells me all about Patrice on my balcony. The two of them, it turns out, were planning on coming here together at one point. They had both applied to Kim Il-sung University through their North Korean contact in Paris, the same one who had arranged Alexander's earlier trip. Apparently, Patrice had been accepted, while Alexander hadn't. Patrice was himself an elite, albeit of the French variety. The nephew of a former prime minister, son of a Hong Kong-based billionaire. When they met in Paris to discuss their shared ambition of studying in Pyongyang, Patrice had been very blunt about his real intentions. When one has money and connections, sanctions are but a minor inconvenience that can readily be sidelined when not overlooked entirely. In Pyongyang, there were business opportunities galore. Didn't Alexander agree? Well, no, not really. His interests in North Korea were purely academic. He really did want to learn the language, study the culture, find out as much about this country as he could. For his sociology degree, he had written his undergraduate thesis on the DPRK. But Alexander also realized that the North Koreans would bend over backward at the mere whiff of a potential investment from someone of Patrice's ilk. Alexander didn't have that kind of capital behind him. His only way in, then, would be to try to become as friendly as possible with Patrice, in the hope that he could at least attach himself temporarily. What kind of business? Alexander didn't know. Patrice's family had their hands in all kinds of ventures throughout East Asia. Hotels, wine, cosmetics. Probably ventures of a less licit nature as well. Alexander could only speculate. When Patrice suddenly stopped replying to his emails, Alexander knew he'd been dropped. He probably figured, who cares? I'm going, he's not. He was definitely surprised to see me there today, Alexander sniffs. Of course, he didn't need me for anything. I would just be in his way. So he must have told the Koreans that it'd be best if he came alone. What's more, with Patrice's profile, it would be essential that no one knew he was in North Korea. My uncle doesn't even know I'm here right now, Patrice told Alexander that afternoon as he drained his third beer. Bullshit, thought Alexander. Everyone knows his uncle is in Hong Kong doing business all over Asia. There's no way Patrice just came here as an independent agent to learn a language he had no interest in. He could have gone to South Korea easily if he wanted to study. These Koreans are all so stupid, Patrice had ranted under his breath between sips. It's unbelievable how brainwashed these people are, unable to fathom the simplest concepts in business. You have to explain everything to them. Not that I'm here to do business, of course, but, you know, while I'm here, I can try to be of some use, a gesture of politesse. But you understand, Alex, there are some things I just cannot tell you. I know things. Actually, I know everything. I was even at the last Workers' Party Congress. They invited me there. And I saw him, the marshal, the man, up close. Do you know what that means? They trust me, these idiots. They need me. Imagine, I am one of the only foreigners in the world to have shaken hands with. His voice trailed off, out of fear of saying number three's name aloud in a crowded restaurant. I know everything, Patrice said, leaning in. I even know things about you, Alex. Things they have told me. What do you know? Alexander asked. Who did you speak to? I cannot say. I have many contacts here. I know many secrets. Patrice's eyes darted around the restaurant paranoically as his voice dropped even lower. They know everything we do, even when we masturbate. You have to be careful what you say here, who you say it to. You might make some minor complaint off the cuff, only to have it repeated to you days later by a complete stranger. They talk to each other, you know. They have networks. They are all crazy, and they know everything. Are you okay, Patrice? You seem a bit nervous. No, I'm fine. Why? You keep looking over your shoulder. No. I'm not nervous. I'm completely fine. Why do you ask such things? Waitress, another beer, and one for my friend. I don't want a beer,
I'm not drinking.
Then I'll drink it for you.
Chapter 25. If Kim Jong-il tried to make the most of his artistic pretensions in formulating a Jucha-oriented literature and cinema, today the most seductive instrument of the state propaganda machinery is music. You hear it in every shop, every restaurant, every taxi you climb into. The sound is quaint, old-fashioned, with its soaring melodies and lyrics of ideological affirmation. But it sinks in quickly. After a few days, you're humming along, every tune recognizable. In those rare moments of silence, I often find myself missing it. Around Alec, I've started jokingly referring to this genre as Norcore, the North's very own version of K-pop. And it is the only acceptable, state-sanctioned style. What it is, really, is a stylistic hodgepodge of virtually every known mode of the anthemic. Disney and Broadway musical ballads, gospel uplift, Chinese synth pop, Russian disco, patriotic folk. And with maximalized sentiment etched into the overall, with operatic, usually soprano, vocals. Norcore's borrowing from all of these genres does nothing to diminish its volkish appeal to mass sentiment. If anything, its defiant hijackings serve as righteous affirmation of survival, of victory, in a world where, let's face it, everyone hates them. It is so catchy, so sticky sweet, that there's something almost sinister about it. The hottest Norcore act is the all-female Moranbong band. It's really the DPRK's house band, each of its members hand-picked by Kim Jong-un, for not just her musical talent, but also her attractive features. The 20-member band performs in matching nursing uniforms with, gasp, short skirts and high heels, a look that must have shocked the audience when it held its first performance on July 6, 2012. It was, after all, only a few years before that Kim Jong-il had decreed that the ban on women wearing trousers was to be lifted. Skirts ending above the knee were something new and salacious indeed. Moranbong's brand of pop wouldn't be out of place aside many of the entries at the Eurovision Song Contest. Lyrics extol the greatness of the country, the military, but also the marshal. His father, Jong-il, also had his own house act, the Pochombyo Band. One's lifelong musical taste is often forged early in life, and Kim Jong-il's was reminiscent of the Oompa-pa songs of the Soviet era that formed the background soundtrack of his childhood and adolescence. By 2012, Pochombyo's Russian disco-inspired tunes sounded embarrassingly old-fashioned. The masses were bored. Kim Jong-un had to grapple with any number of inherited unpleasantries. Among them, the undeniable fact that Western and South Korean pop music had begun to flood in through the underground markets. There was a desperate need to upgrade the country's state sound, to discard all the accordions and Soviet-esque stompery to appeal to the youngest generation, of which Kim was a part. After all, he needed them on his side. Fittingly enough, the Moranbong Band's first public performance was for an audience of university students in Pyongyang. We know from Dennis Rodman that the Marshall's two favorite songs are the themes from Rocky and Dallas. Tunes that undoubtedly implanted themselves in the young Jong-un's brain during his own adolescence, growing up in Switzerland, which were played over and over again by an orchestra on the night of their banquet together, upon the basketball player's first visit to Pyongyang. In addition to this stylistic influence, the Moranbong Band has layered electronic beats, dance breaks, and soulful vocal acrobatics that channel Whitney and Mariah. Concerts are replete with synchronized dance moves, laser light shows, and digital video backdrops showing footage of missiles blasting off into the sky. Ecstatic marching soldiers, and the biggest rock star of all, the Marshal himself, swarmed with hysterical citizen fans. The oversimplified sloganeering and sentimentalism that so often fall flat in cinema and literature and the propaganda banners that fill the landscape prove memorable and persuasive when encased in the gold of pop overdrive. Dash Towards the Future, the song that elicited shouts of Hooray at the mass dance is the anthem of youth, with its calls to reunify the country by staying up all night studying. A celebration of a new country in a new era, the great era of the Workers' Party, a time when the fatherland should be celebrated and extolled for all its wonderful achievements and inventions that have been made famous all over the world. A time that includes, above all, you, the youth of today. Victory Day, every day. Then there's the driving rhythms of Let's Go to Mount Pektu. The beat is infectious enough that one could easily lose oneself in it on the dance floor, if such a dance floor actually existed anywhere in the country. But you can goose-step to it. Soldiers sing it aloud as they march in regimen. At its climax, the melody is transposed to a higher octave, soaring the spirit even higher. Over the chorus, the soulful improvised wails of a soprano hit those Mariah Carey highs, her heart swelling uncontrollably with love of this supreme signifier of the motherland, the sacred mountain of the Korean people. Mount Pektu, where Tangun, the mythical founder of Korea, emerged. Mount Pektu, where Kim Il-sung held fort while bravely fighting off the Japanese. Mount Pektu, where Kim Jong-il is said to have been born to continue his father's fight. It is the place where miracles and fortune are called upon this land, as the lyrics go. Don't make the mistake of thinking it's all just frivolous fun for these bonging Moran babes. There is a serious, sentimental side to the Nor-Kor son aesthetic they espouse. One that suits more contemplative inquiries into the heart of what it means to be Korean. The Nor-Kor canon wouldn't be complete without this ongoing series of slow, moving ballads that one can hardly goose-step to, but that nevertheless serve as sentimental wellsprings for delving into the spirit of the day. With titles like Confession, Burning Wish, and Voice of My Heart, a non-Korean speaker might be fooled into thinking these are mere conventional love songs. While they may not sound so unlike the songs you first slow-danced to in your junior high school gym, these love songs differ in that they are nearly all addressed to one particular human subject. In World of Compassion, soloist Ru-jin Ah meditates on just what it could be that draws so many people, the entire world, really, to comrade Kim Jong-un. Could it be his warmth? His affectionate style? How can it be I feel him so close, she sings. How can it be I feel the heat of his heart burning with love? Just like the crowds that follow him everywhere, smiling and weeping tears of joy, blindly I was also drawn to him, by his mind flaming with compassion. After a lilting string solo, all seven vocalists rise in a chorus. His compassion worth more than tons of gold. Envied by the whole world, even at the end of the sky, a world of endless compassion. His love for us, the Korean people, who all share the same bloodline in our veins, Ru passionately intones, kneeling forward to push the racial affirmation out of her lungs. These songs, like nearly all solos, tend to be sung with so much passion it sometimes sounds as though the singer is about to pass out for want of oxygen. There's the lilting ballad, Burning Wish, in which the marshal is addressed directly. Marshal, soloist Kim Yoo-kyung intones in her endearing soprano, we know you are about to embark upon a long journey late at night, as you must do every night in your selfless devotion to the country. But just to let you know, we are all thinking of you. The drums, mic'd up for maximum reverb, kick in as the chorus rises to its apotheosis. Marshall, we only have one burning wish, that you are in good health. Our happiness, our fate all depend on you, dear Marshall. Flaming heart, burning wish. Lyrically, it's all so hot, and sonically, the fire it most evokes is St. Elmo's. Dwelling on it for long is likely to give you a burning sensation in one part of the anatomy that is never mentioned in any of these songs. The DPRK's brand of socialism has a painfully limited vocabulary. but what it lacks in words, it makes up for in pure, melodious sentiment. Of course, it is overblown, as is all state propaganda. Yet music is the Dionysian form where outpourings of over-the-top